First section, National Council of Jewish Women, Oral History 2, Mrs. Milton Sussman, Interviewer, Jacob Davis, Interviewee, April 27, 1974. Jake, I've known you for a long time, and of course I've known about the history of your family since my childhood. And well, he'd be very interested in finding out more details about you and your remarkable family. Suppose you just start, and I'll interrupt when I think it's necessary, which I shouldn't imagine be too often.
Very good. I'll start with my parents. My father was Barnett Davis, who came to America at the age of 13, about 100 years ago. My mother was Annie Jacobs, better known as Mrs. Barnett Davis, who came to America at the age of 3 with her mother, her sister, and her brother. The age of 13 should be significant because father's mother was determined that papa should not get stuck in the Russian army. And she was brave enough to send her eldest child, my father, to America, where he had no connections, and where at the beginning he had a very bad time. Mother's situation of, I should say that father was born in an area of Lithuania called the Kalvria Triangle, which the big city of which is Königsberg. It's an area quite close to the German border. Papa used to make a joke that if you would drive a buggy into the little town where he was born, the horse would be in Germany and the buggy would be in Russia. Father's family were farmers, dairy farmers. Mother, the situation was different. She was born where she had no right to be born, namely 30 versts, or about 20 miles outside of Moscow. How so? Her father was a soldier in the Russian army. Her mother managed to make a living for herself and her 3 children by following the army as it moved from place to place. And over a period of years, they marched from Moscow through the Caucasian Mountains, a long trip. And my grandmother, or Bubby, who really set the tone for the family, was the kind of woman that would never acknowledge defeat. She never once let down her standards. When the regiment would stop at a certain place, grandmother, a very pious woman, made friends with the village school teacher and the priest, so that she never lost contact with what these days in high-flown terms you'd call the intellectual component of life. In due course, my grandfather, who was a true Geschirrbacher and must have been a terrible soldier, lost his health and the Russians chucked him out. So he went back to his village, accumulated enough money to make a trip to America, found himself completely out of tune with the scene here and took a ship back to his native place. In the meantime, my grandmother accumulated some money and she was on her way to America. So the two crossed in mid-ocean and never saw each other again. So my grandmother landed here with New York with her three children. They didn't do well in New York. The girls worked in sweatshops, and particularly my aunt, Rachel, seemed to be losing her health. So they shipped out and came to Pittsburgh where they had Lance Light. If that's a strange word, that simply means people that came from the same area. And they led the meager, threadbare life of the penniless immigrant. I used the word threadbare. Their life really wasn't threadbare. They lived on nothing a week. But their association with matters of community and charity and intellectuality were not affected by their material circumstance. As a matter of fact, there's a fable in the family that when it came time to eat the Sabbath meal on Friday night, each of the children had to be able to say to the other and to my grandmother that they'd given something away in charity that week. They didn't have enough money to buy a table. They were eating off deal boxes. But charity they had to give. So you see, it was the redoubtable Chayasaro, whose picture is over there against the bookcase, who set the tone for the family.
That was your grandmother.
That was my grandmother. She was a terrible businesswoman. She made a living peddling in the city and on the West End. And she ran into a...
Where did they live in Pittsburgh, Jack? Do you know where they first...
Their first residence was down on Old Avenue, which is out of existence now. It's not far from the jail.
Down in that lower area. Mm-hmm.
Yes. I was born on Washington Street.
Yeah.
Where Chatham Center now is.
Well, that was a fancy street.
That's already a fancy street. It was right opposite the shul. Mm-hmm. So that father could go to shul whenever he wanted to. And where was I before that?
Chayasaro, with her being such a strong character, and the poor businesswoman.
She, coming from the same district in Lithuania, she happened to run into my father, who was a big, tall man, whereas she was a very small woman. And she took him under her wing and mothered him. Eventually, through that contact, my father became aware of the fact that my mother existed. And he asked my grandmother if he had her permission to take Annie out. That was the term that was used in those days. My grandmother answered, "Well, look, don't ask me. Why don't you ask her?" Which he did. Their first date was, let's take an arbitrary day of the week on a Monday, where Papa blew the works and took Mother to theater. Then the second date was on a Tuesday and the third date on a Wednesday, at which time Papa said to Mama, "Look, Annie, what's the use of wasting time? I'll give you from now till Shabbos to make up your mind." And Mother answered him, "Why should you wait till Shabbos?" So you see, there was romance, which the young people as of today think that they invented. Mm. There was romance in those days, too. The father and mother lived together until Papa died at an early age of 56.
How many years have they been married?
Well, I don't know.
Yeah.
I never computed that. Yeah. Had a large family. There were 9 boys and 2 girls. All of whom lived to maturity, except one, who was called Little Jacob. And it's after him that I am named. Or, if you want to put it a different way, I am named after the same man that he was named after. Where the family lived from time to time, I have no recollection, but my thought is, I have no sure recollection. My thought is that family moved from Old Avenue to Federal Street and then to the Bluff. And by the time we were at the Bluff, we were already way up in the world. It was there that I began to go to school. I attended Forbes School, beginning, of course, at the age of 6. By that time, mother or the boss was well known in the city, because it seemed that every person that landed here managed to land in our house at all kinds of hours of the day and night for some kind of help, a little bit of financial help which we could afford, but more particularly the help to get family put together, to send a sick man to Denver, because that was the place you're supposed to get well very quickly, which of course is not true, and so on.
Excuse me just a second. Your father, you said that by the time you moved to Bluff Street, your family was comparatively affluent. What, how had your parents acquired their affluence?
Well, father went into the diamond business. This is a common, this is not at all uncommon in, among the Jews. The tradition of being engaged in a business where one has portable wealth has continued long after the need for having portable wealth, as long after the need has ceased. But at any rate, Papa went into the diamond business, in which he was engaged until my brother David, 4 years older than I, and Max grew up. David was 20 when he entered the business, and Max was 18. And they said to father that he wanted to go into the wholesale business rather than in the retail, and that's how we landed as distributors of diamonds and makers of diamond rings. We lived on the Bluff until the Bluff was no longer fashionable, but more particularly until the house was too small. There were too many children. And when I was about 16 years old, that would be in 1912, 1913, we moved to Aiken Avenue in Shadyside, in a broad, comfortable home where father died and where we lived until eventually we moved to Squirrel Hill.
I remember that Aiken Avenue.
Well, now, where are we now?
Well, you had talked about your mother's involvement with people, and from the very beginning, and what she had given, and then the fact that you had moved out to, had moved from the Bluff to Aiken Avenue.
Well, long before mother, before we moved from the Bluff, mother was inspired by a Dr. Blumberg, and there's one other man whose name I don't know. I think it was Levine, but who he was, I have no idea. The family doctor, Dr. Blumberg, encouraged mother to interest herself in the care of the sick and to start an organization that eventually would be able to take care, A, of Jewish patients, and B, Jewish physicians. We used to have, as I said before, a stream of people coming in and out of the house. And it didn't matter whether it was when either I or my brothers came home from school, or when we came home for lunch, there were customers there. We used the word customers. So way back yonder, and you should have the details in the archives of the city, Mother started the Hebrew Ladies Hospital Aid Society with the idea that a Jewish person who was ill and needed a hospital bed could get a hospital bed, and the mother did not have to intervene with the already well-established hospitals in the city to get an indigent a free bed. There was a second idea behind the Hebrew Ladies Hospital Aid Society, and that was to see that the Jewish physicians would have a place to practice.
Were there many physicians at that, Jewish physicians at that time, do you know?
There were very few. The only one that occurs to me, whose name occurs to me at the moment, is, there was Dr. Blumberg, who died in a tragic accident.
Wexler, too. Wasn't Wexler?
No, Dr. Wexler was later.
Oh.
And Dr. K.I. Sains, who was on the staff at the West Bend Hospital, that's right. Now, it should be pointed out that the intellectuality of these men was no less then than it is now, the intellectual capabilities. As a matter of fact, when the immigrants came from Russia, remember, they did not come from a wasteland where they had a chance to improve themselves either intellectually or financially. They did, and it was only the repressive measures of the Russian government, hitting the people in the Pale of Settlement, which prevented the young men from exercising their abilities and, like a bird, opening their wings and flying on to higher things. But you must not think that at any time the men and the women of that generation had no capability, that they had to come to America to be able to have the same vistas that the people of our generation and our children and grandchildren now have. I don't want to get into the story of the Hebrew Ladies Hospital Aid Society, because that's a long story and should be dealt with in a separate subject. I've tried to give you just a few broad hints about mother who inherited her visions from her own mother, and father who was good-natured enough to allow mother plenty of latitude to do pretty much as she pleased, whether we interrupted dinner or not, and whether we had a good dinner or we didn't have a good dinner. You had to take care of that poor devil that needs a hospital bed. And we boys certainly got sick and tired of those customers. But we were told to mind our own business, which of course we did. The home was a large home, whether even when we lived in the Bluff in a comparatively smallish house. The feeling among the brothers and my elder sister, my younger sister Sida, still hadn't been born, was a very good one. It was one of mutual respect and of love. Now, it's also interesting to point out that even though father was by no means a wealthy man, as a matter of fact, had to struggle, when it came time to educate his children were educated. Of course, they were educated in the public schools. But in addition to that, at a time when there were no cheders, that is, Hebrew schools, in the city, or if there was one community cheder, it was a pretty bad one, we had teachers coming to the house to teach the children one by one their Hebrew lessons to prepare them eventually for bar mitzvah.
Jake, when do, don't, what do you think about the idea of giving all the names of your brothers and sisters?
I shall do just a minute. Mm-hmm. When it came time for my eldest brother, Alan, to get ready for college, there was just no question if you were capable of it, you went to the best college there was in the United States. Now, being a Harvard man, I can say freely, in our opinion, Harvard was the best college in the United States, so that's where Alan went. He went there in 1903. No, he went there in 1903, and he was the class of 1907. Later, my second brother, Hitz, or Isaac, who became a physician, graduated Harvard in 1910. I was the next one who went to Harvard, and I graduated in 1919. And my brother Maurice graduated in 1920. To give the names of my brothers and sisters, the eldest was Alan, who distinguished himself in the city, both as a teacher, as a writer, and as an attorney of law.
Where'd he go to law school?
He went to law school at Pitt. He wanted to be a playwright, and he was a very good playwright. He wrote the first Harvard Prize play, which was called The Promised Land, in competition with men like Ed Sheldon and Knobloch, who became very famous as playwrights. But he was always hip on subjects which are not of general appeal to the public. He had to make a living, and eventually he went to law school at Pitt and practiced in the city in the firm of Duff, Marshall, and Davis, a distinguished firm, because the Duff was Senator Jim Duff, and the Marshall was Judge Elder Marshall. Second in the family was my sister Frieda, who most tragically died in the flu epidemic of 1918. She was an accomplished musician, and I think one of the best voices in the city at that time. The third was my brother Isaac, who became a physician. Where did he go to medical school? Of course, only the best, at Johns Hopkins. The next child was Little Jacob, and he, to this day, is referred to as Little Jacob. He died at the age of 6 of pneumonia. Of course, today he wouldn't have died. Then there was David. Who started to go to Pitt. But when father became ill, with the illness of which he eventually died, David gave up his college and started in business. My brother Max, the next one, who was a brilliant businessman, happened to be a very large man. He refused to go to college at all, not because he didn't want an education, a formal education, but because he felt out of place with men of his own, with boys of his own age, who were so much smaller. But it should not be imagined that Max did not have an education, because he was intellectually very curious. He was avid for knowledge and for learning at all times. I'm the next in succession, and followed by my brother Maurice, then Albert, and then Bennett, and finally my sister Sarah, who is now Mrs. Theodore Abrams. All of the brothers are gone except me. And of the two sisters, only one is left, namely my sister Sarah.
Jake, before we leave this or go on, I'm curious, was there any problem in your admissions to Harvard, any tinge of anti-Semitism, or in Isaac going to Johns Hopkins, or David becoming a member of the law firm of Duff and Marshall?
Ellen. If there were, we were not aware of it, because we always felt that one paddled his own canoe and got places on merit. Alan had no trouble getting into Harvard because he was a very bright man and swam through his examinations. It's ITZ or Isaac got into Harvard, whether a little on the back of his brother Alan or not, I don't know. I doubt it. He got on his own steam. When I went to college, there was no question. I took my examinations and went to Harvard.
Complete acceptance socially, as far as you know?
That's a totally different matter. Once you got to Harvard, you found that Harvard was a very strange place. I can't speak for Alan or Itz, but I can speak for myself. And I was accepted. I was on committees. I was part of the mechanics of the class. But there were certain areas where I was just out. My roommate and still my friend, Malcolm Cowley, who had become a distinguished critic, used to say to me that Harvard was a place that you could love a great deal, that you could respect a great deal, but it was difficult to love because it was a WASP institution. Now remember, by the time I got to Harvard, Charles Eliot, who had been president of Harvard, was no longer there. And we had as president A. Lawrence Lowell, who certainly did not distinguish himself in the Sacco Vanzetti case. As a matter of fact, it later came out when the Board of Overseers divulged their minutes of their meeting that Lowell wished to have a kind of numerous clauses, not actually a numerous clauses as such, but by indirection, that is, at Harvard, a man from, let us say, Montana, could get into Harvard without any trouble, whereas a Jew from New York would have, who might have been a much better man, would have had a very hard time. And the formula that was used was that the college wanted to have a geographical distribution. Well, I doubt the honesty of that statement, and so do many other people. But overall, we were quite happy. I was quite happy at college. There were enough Jewish boys there that we could mingle freely. And I made friends with a great many Gentile boys who had not yet been tinged with anti-Semitism. Socially, we mixed very, very little. Boys from New England and from New York and from wherever it was, Kansas or Missouri, who were boys of great wealth, they went by themselves and had their own societies. We fellas did the best we could. But the impression should not be given that anti-Semitism was any real factor in the life of the undergraduate. If you did your work, and if you gained your place in the class, that's all that was required of you. But I don't want to talk about Harvard because that's a whole subject in itself.
No, I've just brought this in terms of attitudes at that time of whether there was any anti-Semitism. That's the only reason I brought that in and go to such a a special kind of a school, or getting into, for instance, Isaac, getting into Johns Hopkins Medical School.
Well, at Hopkins, it's never felt any anti-Semitism at all. That was a scientific school, and there was no place for that kind of trashy thinking.
Right. Now, then you had started talking then about, telling about who the members of your family were, and we'd gotten down to Sarah.
Yes. Well, I don't know where you want me to go from there. I dwelt on the family. I would like to put it in the capsule form.
Yes.
The capsule form is this, that the family always had a high standard. Alan won scholarships the 3 years that he was there. He finished his 4 years in three. But we never took any money. I won the Harvard College scholarships the 3 years that I was there. I finished my work in 3 years, but I never took any money. We wrote on our own. We gave. We didn't take.
And that's where you've always been, your family.
That's the way the family has always lived. The idea of charity ran all through the family. And it should be pointed out that when my father made a contribution of $500 to the hospital, it was a significant matter. Now today, $500 is no money at all. But in those days, it was money. But if Papa gave $500, that meant that all of us did without something. That, for instance, if it was indicated that we needed a new table here or there in the house, or that I needed a new suit. We did without the table, and I did without the suit. And I remember the resentment I had against my brother David because sometimes I had to wear his cast-off clothes. And Mother could never understand why I felt bad about taking the cast-off clothes of my brother. Not today. The young people are much smarter. They swap clothes around from one child to the other child, and there's no bad feeling. As a matter of fact, they swap clothes with their friends. If a child outgrows a dress, which happens in every family, so what's the difference? The younger one wears the dress, and so on. But the idea that you had to give. Giving was an integral part of your life. You couldn't enjoy your food if you didn't give. You couldn't live if you didn't give. And it hurt. Not today, although I've given far, far more money to so-called charity or public works than Father ever dreamed of, or as a matter of fact, than I ever dreamed of. I've never been forced to alter my lifestyle. I kept on going. So it should be pointed out that that generation who started the various institutions really made sacrifices that counted. Well, not everyone, of course, because some did not give to charity, and some gave so sparingly that it wouldn't make any difference one way or the other. But for us, there was a high standard. Now, whether that high standard was imposed by father or mother, I don't know. They were a team and they worked together. But certainly it stemmed from my grandmother, and for the tradition of tzedakah, which comes from our type of people in the old country.
Jack, wonder before we get into your adult life, what was it like as a child in Pittsburgh? What was your school life like? What kind of recreation was there? What kind of disciplines had to be imposed in school? What was it like to be young in your day?
To be young in our day was to be happy. We were all happy. We were not aware of world problems. Remember that by the time World War I, which changed the course of history, came along, I was 17 years old, and I was already verging on the manhood. I was not aware of anything except having fun like any other kid. I had to do my work, and if I didn't have a good report, high school teachers saw to it that I was hit over the head. Hit over the head, that is metaphorically, meaning to say, if Mary Ruswinkle at Liberty School felt I wasn't doing my work properly, she kept me after school and, figuratively speaking, tore the skin off my back. Not that I wasn't getting along, but because I could do a lot better than I was doing, and she made it perfectly clear that I'd better do better than I was doing or else. But happiness, there was happiness. My friends were Gentiles, as many as Jews. My close friend at that time, whose name I mentioned before, Malcolm Colley, we were inseparable. Matter of fact, there was a group of us, and I was the only Jew in the group. There was Jimmy Light, who was one of the starters of the Provincetown Players.
Mm-hmm.
There was Kenneth Burke, who was just leaving tomorrow, who had come here as the Andrew W. Mellon Professor at Pitt, and as a very famous man as an aesthetician. I call him a pundit. The Jew-Gentile business didn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
And we led very happy lives. There wasn't this nasty schism which you feel, which eventually became quite clear in World War II. Too much socializing we didn't do because I didn't do because I wasn't a socializing kind of young boy. My social life started when I went to Sunday school at Rosh Hashanah. Now, why did I, this child of, at that time, Orthodox, eventually conservative parents, go to Rosh Hashanah? And this, again, ties in with the standards of the family. There was no other decent Sunday school. Went to Rosh Hashanah because that was the best school in town. And that didn't mean that we come in for a free ride. That meant that Papa had to join Rosh Hashanah, or at least pay a fee. I don't know just what happened. And it was there that I made the friends whom I've continued with until this day. That is, those that are living, many of them most regrettably have died. Or many of them have died. And I've kept those friendships up, as I said, until this very time.
Did you feel any dichotomy, a word I learned from you so many years ago, any dichotomy being brought up in an observant, traditional home and then receiving religious education in a classic reformed temple that was ultra-liberal?
No, I felt no dichotomy because our home, we ran our home, that was it.
You didn't feel split?
No. I disagreed with Rabbi Levy constantly, and sometimes I was wise enough to hold my tongue, sometimes I wasn't. When I wasn't, he promptly beat me down. But I never could feel myself a Reformed Jew at that time, because Reformed Judaism at that time was, and especially in Pittsburgh, at Rosh Hashanah, was the ultra of the left. There was no Zionism at Rosh Hashanah. That was a dirty word. Whereas in my home, there was Zionism at the time I was a child. And along with these customers that I spoke about, the Zionist leaders would come and visit at my home. So we had in the home the indigent that came for help and the Zionist leaders and the religious leaders. Now, when the synagogue to which my father belonged as a young man, that is Beth HaMedrash HaGadol, lost its constituency because most of the people moved either to Oakland or to Squirrel Hill, we moved to Shadyside, there was the job of founding a new synagogue. And There was just no question you had to found a new synagogue. B'nai Israel, which now occupies one of the handsomest edifices in the city, was started in a little room above the Camera Phone in East Liberty, Camera Phone being a movie. And who were the movers? Were not solely my father and mother, but certainly they were very much interested in the new synagogue. And the history of B'nai Israel, which is again a separate subject, will show that the steps from Camera Phone to...
I wonder if you could give it briefly, I mean, as much as you can, so because I think that should be a vital part of this.
Well, B'nai Israel was, for years, we conducted the high holiday services in a room above the Camera Phone. It wasn't much. As a matter of fact, it was very little. There was no so-called spiritual leader. There was no rabbi. Who was the Chazan? I don't remember. Who was the Baal Perei? I don't remember. But there was always some man sufficiently educated that he could read the Torah. Then the step from the the next step from the Camera Phone was to the Masonic Temple on Collins Avenue. And it was there that I became Bar Mitzvah in 1910, so that I've been really a member of B'nai Israel for 64 years. No, excuse me, 66 years. I'm the first boy that was ever Bar Mitzvah in B'nai Israel.
Really?
Yeah. Later I became president, and so on and so on, but we won't talk about that now.
But I mean, your whole life's been tied up there.
Whole life has been tied up in B'nai Israel, and the direction of my life in my activities outside my business really started at B'nai Israel. From Masonic Temple on Collins Avenue, we held services then in the Rittenhouse. Now, I may have those twisted. It may be that the services first were held in the Rittenhouse, which was a very nice hotel on Island Avenue. The services may have been held at the Rittenhouse before we moved into the Collins Avenue show. Then there was another step to a building that was bought on Highland Avenue while the present building was being built. But the same type of people, the same mostly Litvox, mostly Orthodox or semi-Orthodox, who knew each other, belonged to the synagogue. Even at this stage of my life, the grandchildren or the children of people that were in shul, some of them still are my friends if they're alive. One of them died just a few weeks ago. We used to joke about how far back our connections went. Eventually, the building on Negley Avenue was built, and B'nai Israel flourished. Mother became a prime mover in the, I don't know what the name of the organization is, the women's group or the women's auxiliary or whatever.
Sisterhood.
You call it. Sisterhood. That's it. And I will say that there's one tremendous satisfaction that the family got. That because while Mother was still alive, although very old, and the new addition to B'nai Israel was built, the women of B'nai Israel, during Mother's lifetime, named it the Mrs. Barnett Davis Social Hall.